is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. My preference is dark chocolate, but almost any kind will do. But behind every box of chocolates and every chocolate bar, lots of stories exist. Some are about growing and processing chocolate. Some are about cultural history of the treat. And the Cincinnati Museum Center is ready to tell all of those stories in a new exhibit opening June the 29th. To discuss chocolate, the exhibit, I am joined by the Chief Learning Officer of the Cincinnati Museum Center, Whitney Owens, and the co-owner and head chocolate maker, oh boy, what a title that is, of the Maverick Chocolate Company, Paul Picton, whose store is in Findlay Market. To join our discussion, call 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. We are also on Facebook and Twitter. Welcome to Cincinnati Edition.
Thanks so much.
Whitney, welcome back. You were here too long ago. And, you know, just to clarify one really simple thing is this is opening June 29th. Where is this going to be in the Museum Center? We all know that there's been this huge reconstruction project going on, and things have been basically closed down there except for the Children's Museum. Mm-hmm. Where's this going to be?
So this is going to be in a newly refurbished, beautiful temporary exhibitions gallery on the lower level of Union Terminal. So if you can picture the entrance to the Duke Energy Children's Museum in your mind, this is going to be right across the hall and right next to another temporary exhibition that just opened called Mission Aerospace.
Okay. So, Paul, we all know it, or most of us know it, in a final form, something that we're going to eat. A chocolate bar, a piece of candy, whatever. But where does chocolate come from? Where does this start?
Well, it starts on a tree. So chocolate grows on a cacao tree, typically down in equator zone, so through Central South America, through Africa. But it grows on a tree, and the seeds are what we call cocoa beans, and that's what we make into chocolate.
And those cocoa beans, the way that they move from being on the tree in those big pods, they're sort of football-shaped pods. And I saw them in Costa Rica when I was visiting there. But are they handled somewhat the same way as coffee beans? How do they go from organic product on a tree to something that you can use in your store?
So there's some similarities to coffee, but the pods are quite a challenge to work with. So farmers will harvest the pods when they're ripe, but then they have a very short window of time to get the pods open and to start the fermentation process. So the chocolate that we all eat is a fermented food, and the beans go through about a 7-day fermentation process. So typically a small farm or a co-op will have their own fermentation tanks, and the farms have to get the beans there typically within 3 hours.
What does that mean? They're fermenting.
So similar to other fermented foods, you know, sauerkraut, kimchi. So it's an actual fermented food where the sugars that are on the beans starts to break down and then starts to actually change the structure of the beans
this
themselves.
This goes back to an interview I did last week. Is there yeast involved?
Not added. It's just that's part of the process naturally occurring.
Okay. So Whitney, it comes, as Paul is saying, sort of from this zone near the equator in Central America, in South America, in Africa. What's sort of the history here? Who started to use these beans off the cacao tree in some systematic way?
So we talk about this a lot in the exhibition. The Maya people were some of the earliest known peoples to actually consume chocolate. And they were able to grow cacao trees in their civilization. And in fact, many Maya actually had household gardens where they could grow cacao. And it was very unlike the chocolate we know today. They would have ground up the cacao beans and mixed it with a little bit of water and possibly some cornmeal or possibly some chilies. And it would have been a drink that was enjoyed by commoners and the elite alike and also used in many Maya religious ceremonies. Later, the Aztec were another culture that people will probably recognize where chocolate played a big role. And they couldn't grow cacao, but they traded for it across long distances, and they accepted it as tribute from the peoples they ruled. And so because of that, because they had to trade these long distances for it, it was very precious. And in fact, cacao beans or seeds could be traded as money in the Aztec culture. So you could go to the Aztec market with your pocket full of cacao seeds and actually trade for your daily groceries. Because it was so precious, chocolate in that culture was only consumed by the upper classes. So if you think of the Aztec rulers, the priests, the other elites, and there again, it was different from what we know today, much more bitter, but maybe mixed with honey or maybe some corn or some chilies. There's a dark red powder called achiote they may have mixed it with. Some people think that that was to make it look more like blood, which played a role in some Aztec religious ceremonies. And all of this is supported by the archaeology. We've actually found Maya vessels that have that cacao residue inside them and Aztec cups that would have been used in these ceremonies. And you can see replicas of those vessels in the exhibit, which is really exciting. And then there's a moment in time, of course, when the Spanish conquered the Aztec in about 1519. And at that time, that was the first time when chocolate made it from the New World back to the Old. So they brought these beans back to Spain. And that was actually the first time that sugar was added to the chocolate recipe,
where it became more like what we know today. Yeah, we'll get to that in a minute. But in terms of those trade routes, there has also been a lot of indication that the bean gets traded up into what is now parts of the United States, particularly New Mexico, the Anastasi settlements. There have been residues there and similar pots that have been found as the Aztecs would have used. We have a caller who's called in. Jack has a question. And Jack, what's your question?
Oh, hi. I'm a coffee. I love chocolate. I don't drink coffee, but I'm concerned about carbon emissions, and I try to, you know, pursue locally sourced food. Coming from the tropics, how carbon intensive is chocolate, and also whether climate change may be causing drought in those regions and affecting the chocolate crop, cocoa crop, cacao crop.
So the question is, really, because there's such a distance here, that the cocoa beans have to be shipped from, what does that do in terms of locally sourcing? There isn't any locally sourcing.
Right. So cocoa beans, say, grow around the equator. We do get some beans from Hawaii. That's the closest, if you will. And so things that we do to try to reduce carbon footprint is just in the way that we do the processing by, doing slow stone grinding, how we try to then source the rest of our stuff locally. We use a lot of other local products. And as far as the other question about climate change and drought, we definitely are seeing that happen. Other chocolate makers, some of the largest ones, have commented that their plantations in the Ivory Coast and Ghana are under threat because of climate change. Their response has not really been ideal, which is we're just going to go clear cut more forest in order to plant more trees at higher elevations. So I think the big companies still have a big challenge of how to deal with those changes. When I was down in the Dominican Republic a couple months ago, we saw that the industry was thriving very well. So I don't think there's a worry that cacao is going to run out anytime soon.
Right now, though, as I understand it, Ghana and Ivory Coast are supplying about 70% of all of the commercial cacao beans. Is that
right?
Is
that's
that correct?
That's
this has shifted from Central and South America over to Africa.
Correct. And the big reason was they could grow plantations out in West Africa much better than they could in Central America. So the plantations parts happened several hundred years ago and have just continued through this to this day.
Jack raised environmental issues, but
There have also been issues in terms of modern production with child labor and slavery, human slavery, going on too. And these are issues that there's a lot of people who are impatient with the big chocolate makers, and I don't think that includes you in Findlay Market, but the big corporate chocolate makers, the pressure they could exert to make a difference here in this sort of thing.
And they really should be. They are, you know, the biggest consumers of those products that are under very questionable ethical standards. And that's a big part of why what we're doing at Maverick Chocolate is to doing something different by directly trading with the small farms and co-ops, knowing who you're dealing with, that we have an assurance of what's happening is helping those communities. And so that to us was a very important part of the business.
So where do your beans usually come from?
So I buy mine from small farms and co-ops down in Peru, Ecuador, Dominican Republic, Belize, and some from Hawaii.
Okay. So, Whitney, just to get back to sort of the story you were starting to lay out, this jump of taking cocoa from the Americas to Europe, something really happened there.
Yes.
And want to play that out a little bit. So what happens when Europe gets involved in this?
So it's a big moment in the exhibition where we talk about the very first time that chocolate, quote unquote, meets sugar, because that begins to turn it into something that's much more recognizable to us today. So when chocolate first comes with the Spanish back to Spain after they've been to the Americas, Spain keeps it to itself for about 100 years or so. We can understand why, of course. And then gradually it spreads across Europe and is this cultural phenomenon. And all of these chocolate houses spring up across Europe. They were like the Starbucks of their day, where you would gather to meet and learn the news of the day and drink chocolate and maybe debate issues.
So both in the Americas, but in the early time in Europe, drinking chocolate was more of a thing than eating pieces of chocolate. Is
that
right?
That's right. That's right. In fact, the saucer was invented for chocolate, to keep chocolate off of the fine clothes of the European nobles who wanted to consume it. And in the exhibition, you can see some really beautiful china sets that look like they could serve coffee or tea, but actually were made to serve chocolate. These very elaborate, you know, 15, 20-piece sets to bring chocolate to the table. And a fine lady in Europe might have expected to wake up to her maid bringing in a cup of chocolate for her to begin the day and give her the stamina she needed to rise from her bed.
It's certainly a health product, right?
Oh, yes. Yes.
Absolutely.
So is this happening at the same time coffee is sort of being introduced in Europe as well? Or are these two competing with each other? Or is this a sequence? I'm not quite clear in my own mind on that.
I don't have the exact timeline on coffee, but my sense is that chocolate houses were very popular the day before coffee houses also became a thing.
Okay.
It was interesting because the mass production of chocolate to go from a liquid to a solid didn't really happen until the mid-1700s. And then the Industrial Revolution, as it was, you know, innovating and making mass production of so many other things possible, had its effect upon chocolate too. And then there was a guy named Van Houten who figured out how to extract cocoa powder from cacao, which made the mass production of chocolate a lot more cost-effective. And that's when you see chocolate being, again, available to the masses and not just the elite in this mass-produced consumable form.
So the powder is more easily transported and handled. Is that what is going on there?
Well, it also allows it to be mixed with a lot of other things. You can mix it with water. So cocoa powder is about 50% of a cocoa bean. If you were to press it, about 50% would be the oil, which we call cocoa butter. The other 50% is cocoa powder.
Hmm.
But the bean itself with the oil doesn't blend very well. You can't mix it with water quite readily because the oil and water just don't mix. So if you now take that powder, you can blend it with a lot of other things. You could blend it with milk. You could blend it with water.
Oh,
and that's what made it then more accessible to the masses.
Okay. So it's just more flexible and more usable in different formats.
Correct.
So, okay. Now, you know, the three of us, we live in Cincinnati. This is the home of Procter & Gamble and the home of branding. Part of the story of chocolate or any other mass-produced food is how it's branded and what people are told about it, taking it from a commodity to something that has intrinsic value is the whole magic of branding. So, you know, I think of lots of branding elements with chocolate, with cocoa. But for me, it's Toll House cookies. You know, it's like, so talk a little bit about how that branding influences the development of our taste for chocolate.
Well, I think branding becomes very important because the chocolate that we consume is always been processed to some level. So chocolate chips are processed in a very different way than chocolate bars or chocolate milk or the chocolate that goes into Oreos or ice cream. So all of those are different forms of chocolate, come from different beans, different ways that they've been handled.
So different varieties of beans? Is that what we're talking about?
No, more of processing than okay. variety. There are varietal differences. There's different kinds of, you call it quality, like in coffee where you've got Robusta and Arabica. In chocolate, we usually talk about Forastero as being sort of the bulk chocolate, and then Trinitario and Criollo as being the more preferred fine flavor chocolates. And so those beans, regardless of the variety, are often pressed and then processed to make a particular flavor. So if you want a Toll House cookie chocolate chip, it is made to a specific recipe and their in-house blenders then blend the beans to produce that same flavor of chocolate over and over again, the same way that, say, a bourbon blender works at a distillery to produce that same flavor over and over again.
So, Paul, you work with, live with chocolate all the time here now.
Yes.
Do you have a favorite form, a favorite type, a favorite flavor? I'm not sure. All of those. What do you like?
So my personal favorite is what I call dark milk chocolate. So it sounds like an oxymoron, and in some ways it is, but it's basically about a 60 or 65% dark chocolate that has milk powder and vanilla beans added into it. So you get the creaminess, the richness of a milk chocolate, but without all of the sugar. And pretty much every afternoon I have some with my afternoon coffee break.
Okay. Whitney, how about you? Are you a coffee connoisseur, a chocolate connoisseur?
Well, I have to say my favorite is a really good chocolate cake. But I was sharing a story before the program where I actually was part of the team that developed this exhibit originally at the Field Museum in Chicago. And during that process, as we were learning more about cacao content in chocolate bars, you know, we were trying to get ourselves up to like a 70%, 80% cacao in the chocolate bar, which actually is very bitter. And so we ended up pulling back from that. And I have to say, I prefer more, something around like 50 to 60% is more my style.
Yeah, I can go higher than that. I really like the bitterness. That's fun. You know, you were talking about oxymorons before, Paul. What about white chocolate? Is that an oxymoron?
It does not have to be. It often is. The white chocolate that people are familiar with usually contains no chocolate. It's sugar, whey powder, and typically hydrogenated palm kernel oil. But there is real white chocolate, and that's made with cocoa butter. And if you take the beans, you press them, extract the oil out, we call that cocoa butter. If you use that as the main ingredient of your chocolate, you can actually call that white chocolate.
Okay. So what's the future of chocolate here, Paul?
I think the future is the craft movement. Guys like Maverick Chocolate and other small craft chocolate makers are producing fine flavor chocolate. It's no longer just a generic sort of commodity product, but we're seeing that same trend that happened in coffee, that's happened in beer, where people are interested in the story of the chocolate. Where did it come from? Who is your farmer? And what are those unique flavors and tastes that I can get out of that? And that's where we see chocolate growing.
So at your store, are you experimenting with how to do that?
Yes. I mean, right now we have six different single origin chocolates where the beans come from six different farms and they all taste radically different from each other. Some taste like they've got raisins or raspberry jam in. Some taste like honey. Others taste like cinnamon. And that's just the nature of the beans themselves.
Can you confirm or deny that chocolate is part of my favorite food, Skyline Chili?
I have no knowledge of that.
You have no knowledge of that. Okay. I'm going to keep eating it anyway. on the exhibit, Whitney, what, you know, people will learn a lot. Will they have access to chocolate?
Yes, we are going to have some tastings throughout the exhibition's run, and it opens here on June 29th. Mm-hmm. And so our first confirmed tasting is on July 7th. And so there will be opportunities, both for you to taste some chocolate at Union Terminal, but one of the wonderful and some would say cruel things we do is we actually pipe the smell of chocolate into the exhibit. So if that gets your taste...
Oh, come on.
I know. If that gets your taste buds watering, we will also have a very well-stocked retail section where you can purchase some chocolate to your heart's content and satisfy your craving that way.
Oh, okay. Well... The exhibit's opening June the 29th. Your store is open every day.
Yes.
So there's lots to do here. Thank you to Whitney Owens and to Paul Picton for being with us today. And I'm sure this is going to be a big draw at the Museum Center. You've been listening to the Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer of today's show is Pete Reitmeier. Selena Reeder is our assistant producer. Layla Shakui is our intern. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Archives of our programs are available on the website wvxu.org. I'm Dan Hurley. Stay tuned for Here and Now on 91.7 WVXU.